want to express gratitude for y'all's beautiful music ministry. It's been a delight to be with you all. And my sermon this morning begins with a reading, though it physically comes out of this book of readings for use in Unitarian Universalist worship, is originally the work of the poet Alice Walker. It's the epigraph to the first chapter in her book of poetry called Revolutionary Petunias and Other Poems. To acknowledge our ancestors means we are aware that we did not make ourselves, that the line stretches all the way back, perhaps to God, or to gods. And we remember them because it is an easy thing to forget that we are not the first to suffer, rebel, fight, love, and die. The grace with which we embrace life, in spite of the pain and the sorrows, is always a measure of what has gone before. So a few years ago, a book came out, and maybe some of you bought it, and maybe some of you sort of bought into it, and maybe you just heard an interview with the author on NPR. But the book is called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Right? And so it sounds from your chuckles, it sounds like some of you maybe felt like you ought to discover the life-changing magic of tidying up, but like me, did not. And so the core concept, right, I'll give us some cliff notes to get us moving this morning, and the core concept of the book is what author Marie Kondo calls her KonMari method. And so her method for tidying up the things in your life is that rather than focusing on what you need to throw away, you focus on what you need to keep. Right? And you collect all your possessions in a given space, and you hold each one in your hand, this pen, for example. And you ask the still small voice within you, does this bring me a spark of joy? And if it does, you have to find a place for it and you can keep it. And if it doesn't, you have to give it away. And so, though anybody who's ever seen the interior of my office knows that I personally have not discovered the life-changing magic of tidying up, I wish sometimes that someone would provide a guide for me, not about the life-changing magic of tidying up my physical closets and my physical space, but that someone would help me deal with my interior clutter. Right? The stuff that tends to collect in us. The grudges, the dashed dreams, the lost hope, the hurt, all those pieces that kind of clog up the closets in our hearts. Because we cannot, alas, get rid of everything in our lives that doesn't bring us joy. I wish that I could say, oh, if that memory doesn't bring you a spark of joy, you can just leave it behind. But life is not quite that sunny. Because the truth of the matter is that hidden in all of that clutter inside of us is the story of who we are. Among all those grudges and dashed dreams and hurt and loss is what makes us us. It's our story. It's our ancestry, both as individuals and as communities. In among all that junk, there is some magic. Some not cheap magic, but the real kind of transforming power that we can find in our own histories and in our own stories. And I think that this morning's reading from Alice Walker has a powerful reminder for us that these stories started before we were born, right? That we, each of us, stepped into a story that was already being written. Stories that don't just begin with our parents, but begin with their parents and their parents and their parents. And however you define the other end of that story, whether you think of it as a creator or whether you think of it as rising up out of the blue-green algae, either way, our story has a beginning. And it didn't start the moment we were born. As much as we might like to believe that we are totally special and that the world indeed did not turn until we were on it. And so Alice Walker reminds us, right, that we are not the first to experience struggle. We're not the first people to want to rebel against injustice. We are not the first people to love so fiercely that it hurts. We're not the first people to experience loss or death. But, and I don't know about you all, but sometimes these days it feels like that struggle is just so ever present. And it feels sometimes new. And it feels sometimes newly difficult in our lives. And so this morning, I want to invite us into three practices, three ideas, three approaches, three ways to get back in touch with our stories, with our histories, both as individual people and as whole communities, to get back in touch with some of that transforming magic that's in and hidden among all of that clutter. And so the first practice for discovering and recovering some of that life-changing magic in our history is to reach back. Maybe you have been told before that we really ought to just get over the past. Right? You bring up a past hurt or a past struggle, and somebody says, like, you know, that was 50 years ago. Can't you just get over it? Can't you just let it go? But what if, instead of telling each other to just let past hurt go, we took it in our hands and wondered, what can it teach me? Not how can I hold on to the grudge, but what can it teach me? What can I learn from this piece of history? And a history that I've been thinking a lot about lately and wondering what we can learn from it is some of the stories of some of the original suffragettes, right? We had a woman who was a candidate for president of a major party. We are coming up on the centennial of women's suffrage. And I've been thinking about what religious educator, UU religious educator Gail Forsyth Vale calls our ancestors' capacity for great insight and great oversight. Because I've been thinking about women like Susan B. Anthony and Carrie Chapman Catt, and how part of how they advocated for their right to vote was that they specifically advocated the right for white women to vote. They advocated a white woman's right to vote as a way to consolidate the white vote against people of color. Shouldn't we as white women, have the right to vote before black men, before immigrant men? It was part of their argument for suffrage. And they were capable of great insight and great oversight. And I say this not to, you know, take away your sheroes, not at all, but to suggest that we cannot simply let the past go without wondering what we might learn from it. And this history came up again in my mind when, after the election, there was sort of this big upswell of energy on Facebook, right, from a group that maybe some of you were aware of called Pantsuit Nation. And in this Facebook group, there was this big upswell of energy, and a lot of women said, you know what, we're going to march on Washington. We are going to show that we, sort of beyond the results of this election, we have a political will that will be heard. And right at the beginning, all of the organizers of the march were white women. And man, I tell you, I was so afraid. I was so nervous that we were going to do it again. That we were going to ignore the diversity of what it means to be a woman. And you know, I will say, I have never been more delighted to have been proven wrong. Because what happened was that folks didn't forget the past. They looked at it and wondered, what can we learn from it? And they said, we need a more racially and ethnically diverse group of women organizers. And amazing women like Tamika Mallory and Carmen Perez and Linda Sarsour came together and organized the march. They said, you know, just because this was what the previous chapter said doesn't mean we have to write the same story over again. We can reach back into our history and write a new story, a new chapter. Not to gloss over what happened, but to acknowledge it and say we can do something different. And so we have to reach back into our history. But we don't just need to reach back. We also need to reach deep, to reach deep in our histories. Because so often when we think about history, we are thinking about it. We want to recall facts. We want to recall exactly what happened, rather than connecting with the feeling of the struggle, of the events, of that grand tradition of struggle in human existence. And speaking of the grand tradition of struggle in human existence, before I went to seminary, I taught middle school. I consider it one of the greatest struggles in human existence. Not my personal experience of teaching middle school, which I actually really liked doing, but rather just the general concept of middle school. Just those eights, not a great time for anybody. And so when I was a middle school teacher, oftentimes students would sort of end up in my classroom before or after school or during lunch. And it was those times we had some of our best conversations because, frankly, sometimes they forgot that there was an adult in the room. And one day, two of the students from my intermediate English to speakers of other languages, or ESOL class, were having a very heated discussion about a romantic tragedy currently plaguing one of them. It's just so hard to be in love. I think I might die. Half concerned, half curious, I sort of inserted myself into the conversation and I asked her what the problem was. Oh, Miss Roberts, it's horrible, she said. I never see my boyfriend. Does he live far away? No, he lives across the street. Oh, but he goes to a different school. I have to wait all day to see him. I think I probably rolled my eyes and said, you'll be fine. Oh, Miss Roberts, she moaned. You just can't understand what it means to be in love. I sort of stared at her with raised eyebrows, until her friend started giggling, and then she blushed as she realized that maybe I did know what it meant to be in love, which is not something that any 13-year-old ever wants to think about their teacher, like being in love. But the more I think about that story, the more I think that maybe there was something to her point. That I, in that moment, I had no idea. I was not aware of what it felt like to be 13 and in love. Because sure, I recalled that I had done something similar in my past and I'd turned out okay. I was thinking about my past rather than reaching deep into it and remembering what it felt like to be in that place and in that moment and in that struggle. And so often, too often, when we talk about our history, whether it's our individual stories, our family stories, or the stories of our whole community, we think about the past and we neglect to connect with the feeling of the past. We neglect to see ourselves as part of a struggle, as part of an emotional bond. So I invite us to recall the feelings of our past, the emotions, not to relive past traumas, but to remember both the exhilaration and the heartbreak of what it means to be human. And hopefully, when we do that, we start to see through the clutter a little bit of that transforming magic of the stories of who we are. And so, once we've reached back into our history and we have reached deep into the story of what it means to be human, we have one step left. And that is to reach out. Alice Walker describes this in a way I love. She says, "The grace with which we embrace life, the grace with which we can reach out past those old fears, those old grudges, those dashed hopes, the grace with which we can embrace life." And there's lots of ways for us to reach out into this new future that we are always writing. It can be as simple as picking up your phone and getting in touch with an old friend or an old family member whose relationship has fallen away with you. It can be as difficult as struggling against your own internalized bias. As you engage in community service and community organizing, reaching out can look lots of ways. And honestly, more often than not, reaching out looks above all unexpected. When I was in seminary, I had to take an art class to fulfill a graduation requirement. Wesley Theological Seminary had a big emphasis on the worship arts, and there were lots of ways you could fulfill the requirement. You could take painting, you could take screen printing, drawing, stained glass, bead making, quilting, all kinds of different art classes. But all of those had lab fees. So I took liturgical dance. My classmates all laughed, just like you guys, because I did not present myself as the kind of person who did things like liturgical dance. Indeed, I hadn't taken a dance class since elementary school, where I was forced to learn square dancing in gym. It's an important life skill. And on the first day of that liturgical dance class, oh my goodness, I was so nervous. I was so nervous, nervous like I had not been in ages. Because, you see, normally in class, right, there's things like this between us, right? There is a podium between the professor and the students. There are tables in front of us. We have our laptops and our books and our notes. There's all of these barriers between us. There's all of this physical stuff that puts space between me and you, that lets me feel comfortable and kind of hidden. And when I showed up on that first day to liturgical dance, all of the tables and all of the chairs were pushed to the side, and there was nothing but a big empty space in the middle of the room. Oh my goodness, where do we even sit? And everybody was dressed differently. We had all patched together some kind of athletic gear, and you could tell which of us had exercised less recently than others. Sort of out-of-fashion athletic clothes. I was so worried because I thought, oh my goodness, we might have to hold hands. I might have to touch somebody else. I might sweat in front of them. I will surely fall down. Someone will laugh at me. And I was right to think all of those things because all of those things did happen. I sweat. I fell down. We had to hold hands almost every day. And I did, and I fell down some more, too. In fact, there was a jump in the final performance of our semester that we did in the chapel service for Advent at seminary, and eventually the jump was taken out of the routine because I simply could not do it. And I learned that there are some barriers that indeed cannot be crossed. Me jumping is one of them. And my goodness, people laughed at me, and I laughed too. Because something amazing happened when we took all of those tables and all of those preconceived ideas about who each other were out of the way, and we had unbelievable human connection in that class. My goodness, I felt more connected to the folks in that dance class than anybody else I met in seminary. Because when we took those barriers out of the way, when we reached out past our fear, past our ideas about who each other were, we were able to connect. We were able to find some magic in our story together. We cannot rewrite the past to make it only joyful things. Our stories and the story of all humanity is complicated. It is one of struggle and loss and love. But what we can do is work on some of our clutter, some of the grudges and the fears that become barriers between us, to find some of the transformation and some of the magic in our own stories, because what comes next is not yet written. It remains for us to write, today and every day. We do not have to relive the past, but honor it and write a new chapter today. My hope for this community and for all of us in our lives is that we may know our stories and write ever more joyful ones for ourselves and for our world. May it be so. Amen.